Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Nathan Alley. I'm an attorney with the Environmental Defense Center in Santa Barbara. I also want to mention that I'm from a farming family in the Ohio River Valley, and I realize that actually kind of marks me as an invasive species. But the reason I mention it is because I want to assure you that when I think farmer, I don't think industry. I think of my grandfather, who's 91 and still drives a tractor pretty much every day in the summer. That kind of reflects the theme of the comments I'd like to make, which picks up on something that Steve was talking about earlier, kind of a sense of optimism. First of all, I want to mention that I did serve on the stakeholder panel that was convened in December of 2008. I really enjoyed my time on that, and I was sorry to see it ultimately dissolve. I think we were making some good progress. I was not on the stakeholder panel in 2004. However, someone from my organization was, and I feel well informed about how that process went. And so one thing I'd like to do is commend everyone who participated in that process, and then everyone who's been following through with the order over the last 6 years. We've certainly heard a lot of information about how water quality is getting worse in many areas, and that's a problem that your board needs to address. But I think we also can stand up here and commend agriculture for the work they've done to at least attempt to improve water quality with this waiver program. I also mentioned the 2004 process because when I came into the stakeholder process in late 2008, it was my understanding that there were some issues that had essentially been tabled in 2004 in the interest of moving that initial waiver along, with the expectation that those issues were then going to be picked up again in 2009 during the renewal process. And so I think some of the more controversial issues that we're kind of grappling with right now are things that have actually been a long time in the works. And to that end, I also would like to join people in commending your staff for putting together a draft order that I think really goes a long way in shoring up some of the weaknesses in the current program. Now, your board is certainly charged with protecting water quality. That's what you're here for, and I urge you to do that to your utmost capability. But I also want to continue this theme that agriculture is the most important part of our community, not only economically, but it really is the lifeblood of everything that we do. And so I think the most appropriate thing for us all to do is strike a balance between protecting water quality and making sure that agriculture is sustainable and viable. But I really do believe that the draft order, as currently proposed, provides the tools that are necessary to achieve that balance. And one example, something that is controversial, but I think ultimately a fantastic idea, is the individual monitoring. And I'll just say that provides a tremendous opportunity for folks who are implementing good practices and who are doing the right thing to essentially exonerate themselves from being part of the problem that we see. And then for other folks that may identify problems coming off their farms, well, we can work with them to improve their operations and to make our water cleaner. I just want to close by saying we are looking forward to seeing you promulgate a new order in July or as soon as you can thereafter. And we're always here willing to keep the conversation that we started at the stakeholder panel alive and hopefully all work together moving into the future. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Quant.
Thank you. My name is Richard Quant. I'm speaking to you today as president of the Grower Shipper Association, represent vegetable and strawberry growers in the Santa Maria area. I was also a member of the original Agricultural Waiver Advisory Panel, whose recommendations were adopted by this board in 2004. That process was a collaborative effort that built upon efforts between farmers and the conservation community to implement irrigation practices that improved water quality. The waiver program that was adopted was one that leaders within the agricultural community helped develop. Those leaders then went out as ambassadors and sold the concepts embedded in that program to the farmers within the region. An agency that's known for its regulatory approach to point source dischargers had unexpectedly gone outside the box and successfully herded up over 2,000 farmers and were moving them down a long and difficult path towards improving water quality. While other regions in the state struggled, the vision of this board and the efforts of your staff moved the process along in adopting a very successful program. I think the efforts of your staff, particularly Allison Jones, need to be recognized. When I walked into the room during the 2009 advisory panel process, as it was convened, it became quickly apparent to me that things had changed. All of the environmental representatives had been replaced with new individuals. Michael Thomas was now overseeing this process, and he basically told the panel in no uncertain terms that the new waiver would include new regulatory elements and that they weren't open for discussion. Instead of thinking outside the box, the panel was placed within Michael Thomas's box. And the only thing that they were really interested in was the panel addressing some milestones towards achieving these elements. More than a year later, we are here today still trapped inside that box. Staff has developed some recommendations for a new waiver that they believe reflect the board's desires and will be adopted by the board. And if that is not the case and you want to change things, you need to speak up today and provide some new direction to the board. Help all of us involved in that process break outside of the box and get this process moving forward again. You need the participation of each and every farmer to improve water quality within the region. We are not your enemies. Don't treat us as such. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. But before we get to you guys, I forgot, a lady asked me to speak. She's on the bottom of this list, and I want to let her speak at this time because it is an organized presentation. LaVon Stone?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. I'm the executive director of the Fort Ord Environmental Justice Network. We have been operating for a number of years, since the 90s, and we represent a very large community in Monterey County. One of the problems that we have is, especially with the agriculture runoff, is that the rules and regulations and forms of implementation don't seem to apply to every area of the state. When it comes to Fort Ord and pesticide use and how those pesticides are used, it's almost a closed operation. Groundwater contamination, we seem to have different rules for how we operate and use our water. We have children who are severely impacted in Monterey County. Lead in the drinking water is also a problem, and how that lead gets in the drinking water is should be talked about. And how we get our information, the public process seems to be open not to the disenfranchised and poor communities that have been greatly impacted, but the economic situation of those communities don't allow the resources and the information to get to them in timely fashions. As a matter of fact, it was hard to even get this information. And in Monterey County, I have to come to San Luis Obispo to find out what exactly is going on in Monterey County, because our information process is very limited in how we receive that information. And when it comes to these types of meetings, I always look around the room, and what I see when it comes to African Americans is always very, very small or none at all. And that is a big problem, but nobody seems to be bothered by that. I mean, we do have African American people living in California, and in Monterey County, and any other county, I would think. But instead of looking at the problems of how we get our information out to the communities need to be informed. We're talking about public trust. We have a big problem with public trust. We have a big problem with environmental justice. The environmental justice regulations have now turned into words or phrases saying environmental justice for everyone. Well, they have not been applied. I thank the Water Board for what they are doing, because they are at least now looking at health impacts. And I was thrilled to hear that, because we don't hardly have anybody looking at environmental health impacts. But I don't want you to only look at them. I want you to include us, talk to us, have an open process where we can get to you and where we can find out what's happening, what we need to do in order to protect ourselves, because we don't have the resources to do those things. We need to be able to partner with people in our area. The students at CSUMB University, I did a presentation for them, and the seniors told me that they were finally told not to drink the water. They have been greatly impacted. They all come to us. San Dorado came to us, Chular, the people in Moss Landing that was living right where they were using the chemicals for the strawberries, came to us, and we go and we represent them. We represent them to the Board of Supervisors and everywhere else. So I would appreciate it if we could do something about our limited communication process and how that information gets to the people who really need it. Pesticides in Monterey County has always been a huge problem. People getting sick and dying, and they still are. I know, and nitrates as well, but pesticides as well. I would like to see that, okay, it's red, I'm winding up. I would like to see a sincere effort for us to talk about how to disseminate the information that we need to get to the public. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Folks, why don't we take our first break of the afternoon? You guys don't go anywhere. I mean, we're ready to go, but we need a restroom break. And let's make it 10 minutes. All right, 10 minutes. So some of you don't have to get up, but just stretch. Okay, please, would everyone take their seats? Okay, thank you. I'm taking one more speaker out of line because he's got to leave early. Go ahead, sir. I have your card somewhere in here. Please go ahead.
Fred Collins.
Okay.
My name is Fred Collins. I'm tribal administrator for the Northern Chumash Tribal Council. Our stewardship is San Luis Obispo County. Our home is from Ventura, Malibu area, all the way up to San Luis. So the Chumash are watchers of the water. The water for us tells us the condition of Mother Earth, Hutash. Hutash is our name for Mother Earth. And we find that the water is being degraded. That's a message that everyone should look at very carefully. We applaud the staff's magnification of this problem. It's important to us to take care of the water. We watch all of the creeks in San Luis Obispo County, and we're very careful, and we attend all of the meetings and make our voice heard. Native Americans in California, I'm sure, feel all the same way that we do. It's important to take care of the water. How we do that is very important also. We need to work together, and we need to make it simple. We're an agriculturalist also. We farm. We're farmers. So we know what the farming community is going through. It's very difficult, and it's costly for them. But we need to do it in a good way. We need to do it together, and we need to come up with solutions. We're here. We have a lot of intelligent people in this room. It's very important that we all work together to make this thing happen. And it's important that we just don't point a finger at agriculture. There's an oil industry out there that's got oil sitting on top of our water tables all throughout San Luis County that are causing some very toxic waste situations in our creeks. So it's a combination problem, and it's a combination solution. So the Northern Chumash Tribal Council supports the staff in magnifying this issue, but we also support that all of us work together to come up with a solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Okay. Now
can
we can go.
Can you guys see the monitor anymore? The screen?
You're asking if I can. We can see that?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's see. Dr. Hunter and Mr. Hodgson, can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay.
We moved it so that you folks are not so much behind you.
Okay, thank you, Roger. Thank you, Chairman Young and the board members. I'm here as part of the ag proposal. And I'd like to start off with the conditional ag waiver renewal process began in late 2007, with the agricultural community inquiring to the regional board staff about the renewal process. At that time, Allison Jones from your staff did not think there would be any substantive changes in the adopted initial waiver, and the overall feeling from staff was that the program was working and complemented agriculture stepping up and making the largest program focused on water quality in the region a success. In December of 2008, ag panel members were asked by Roger Briggs to begin working on the waiver renewal process. During that initial meeting, we quickly learned that the agricultural water quality program was now the agricultural regulatory program, and new staff members from the regulatory division were assigned to incorporate a new vision in addressing water quality, while ignoring the unprecedented success in the initial waiver. There was no longer a request for collaboration from panel members. Rather, the panel was given a list of non-negotiable regulations that would subject Region 3 growers to the most rigorous regulatory program in the state. The reluctance of staff to collaborate and listen to the concerns of panel members was extremely disappointing and ultimately caused the process to break down. At your board meeting in October of 2009, I asked the board to consider having a workshop with agriculture so we could discuss the positive as well as the negative aspects of the initial waiver. There are always areas in a new program that can be improved upon. Agriculturalists in Region 3 followed through with every condition of the initial waiver, from forming the Nonprofit Preservation Inc. to administer the monitoring program, to the farmers who took the 15-hour classes and are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars improving their irrigation infrastructure and on-farm management practices. We are now just seeing some of the beneficial results from those practices in certain areas across Region 3. The goal of the initial ag waiver that was adopted in 2004 was to improve water quality over time. You will see after listening to our proposal, agriculture is still committed to that goal. Thank you very much.
Chairman Young, members of the board, Kirk Schmidt, Preservation Inc. We wanted to give you kind of an executive summary of the alternative proposal, starting out with not a rebuttal or any critique of the previous presentations, but just a look at the draft alternatives prepared by your staff. Staff commented in their press release that there's been a reduction, that there has been less than full enrollment in the ag waiver process since 2004. Yet we've had consistently 1,700 to 1,800 growers enrolled over the last 5 years. Staff says that there are approximately 3,000 growers in the area. We don't know where they are, but 93% of the acres in the area are enrolled. The other growers are unidentified, and we desire that staff seek out those growers and enforce the ag waiver so that they become part of the process. There was a requirement that every grower had to have a farm plan, and 89% of the enrolled growers have farm plans. There was a requirement that everyone had to participate in the cooperative monitoring program or individually monitor their own water. 100% of the growers that are enrolled participate in the cooperative monitoring program. There's a group of growers that are unknown that don't participate in the cooperative monitoring program and are non-enrolled, and staff established goals in 2004, internal goals in 2004, to have 75% of the growers enrolled by 2006, yet today in their press release they state that they haven't achieved that at this point. However, there is one thing that both staff and the cooperative monitoring program agree on, and that is that water quality has improved in some areas in the agricultural community. The farm plan, we commented on six elements of the ag waiver, and I'm going to address them quickly, and we'll address them in greater detail as we progress. The farm plan in the ag proposal is for an annual report to be filed with the water board by every grower that's enrolled in the program. The draft proposal is that every grower should submit detailed business records to the Regional Water Quality Control Board, showing what their production are, what their production is on each field, including all of their inputs. We believe accountability through reports is much more effective and much more effective from the farmer, and much more reasonable, and that we'll have much lower paperwork to deal with at the water board. On-farm inspections were provided for in the 2004 waiver. Although only 55 farms were inspected in 6 years, we believe that this is the best way to have enforcement with the growers, is to have on-farm inspections. At that time, their farm plan would be available to the regional board staff, as opposed to the draft proposal, which is deliverable to the water board, including all the information contained in it. The business records of farmers, just like any other business, should be confidential. Farmers compete with each other. To make their records public would mean that their neighbors would be able to know what gives them a specific advantage in their crop production. The staff, in a press release, has acknowledged that business records are confidential and that there should be some way to provide for information to be delivered to the water board without having it become a public record. Practice implementation. We believe that every grower who's enrolled in the program should summarize their water quality practices. The staff proposal provides for detailed daily fertilizer, water, and chemical records to be maintained and submitted with the farm plan to Region 3 upon request. Records of practices is what's really important to show that there's an improvement in water quality, not wasteful paperwork. The growers must demonstrate that they are implementing practices to eliminate discharge. The staff's proposal has a hierarchy of very short timelines to have elimination of discharges, starting with 2-year elimination of tailwater and toxicity, 3 for sediment, 4 for nutrients and salts. The goal is to improve water quality in a way that's technically and economically feasible, and these short timelines are not. The practices that are necessary to improve water quality are different from each farm. The staff proposal suggests that one size fits all. It's always better to have a custom-tailored program than one that's off the shelf. Tile drains require specific attention because they are necessary in areas of high perched groundwater. The staff proposal initially proposed that they be eliminated in 2 years, although staff has indicated that they are dropping a timeline on tile drains. Highly impaired watersheds need more time, not a shorter timeline for termination of discharge, primarily because it's going to take longer to solve the problems in those areas. That's why they are highly impaired. The agricultural proposal contains a section for 5 hours of education during a five-year period. The initial waiver provided for 15 hours of education in a five-year period. We believe that this was fundamental in bringing all of the growers up to standard on a technical level as opposed to an agronomic level dealing with discharge, and the same thing should be included in the upcoming waiver. There is no similar proposal in the staff draft. The ag proposal for monitoring is to maintain the cooperative monitoring program with 18 constituents. Staff's proposal is 48 constituents. However, even with 48 constituents, they're only actually dealing with four problem-solving constituents. There's no reason for the additional expense of these constituents when the present program has been successful in showing where areas are impaired and where areas are not impaired. The staff proposal calls for expensive, excessive on-farm reported monitoring. The ag proposal calls for non-reported on-farm sampling that would be maintained by the grower. The key is to give information to the growers on how to improve water quality. Without that information, they can't improve water quality. The staff proposal for follow-up monitoring is unspecified additional monitoring because the MRP has not been written at this point. The ag proposal is for a rotating follow-up, giving the flexibility beyond the core CMP so that we can address areas most in need of additional monitoring information. The groundwater is something that's been discussed at great length here today. We propose that existing government agencies or third parties develop a groundwater management plan within 5 years. Staff's proposal is to have a monitoring program, a monitoring plan in 2 years. In any case, there's a recognition for an additional research which is necessary in order to determine what to do with groundwater. The one thing that the agricultural alternative did not address was land use regulation. We believe that there's no jurisdiction for the regional board to have over land use regulation as proposed in the draft waiver, and so there's no commonality between the two proposals in this area. And then each of these areas will now be addressed in a greater detail by further presenters.
The true goal of a conditional ag waiver or any water quality program is to improve water quality. Both the California Water Code and the Regional Board's Basin Plan provide the authority for the Regional Board to impose regulations on dischargers to improve water quality. However, the manner in which water quality is improved must be reasonable. There is no need for the Regional Board to impose arbitrary restrictions on commercial agriculture so long as farmers take necessary steps to demonstrate water quality improvements over a significantly feasible timeline with intermediate milestones. Rather than arbitrary and capricious regulations, the region needs a workable long-term solution which is not limited to five-year periods of time. In addition, agriculture needs open collaboration with the Regional Board. In order to be successful in reaching goals, the agricultural community, who are equally concerned about water quality and the environment, join together to create a workable, feasible, and attainable approach which is proactive and has the true goal of improving water quality in mind. As recently stated, the agriculture's proposal includes six key areas: the farm plan, education, land use regulations, monitoring, practice implementation, and groundwater. Key features of the plan include tailoring water quality improvements to the specific needs of individual farms rather than a one-size-fits-all approach, a focus on education rather than on punishment, continuation of a successful cooperative monitoring program supplemented by confidential, voluntary on-farm sampling conducted by growers, and the creation of a long-term water quality plan to replace the current five-year programs. Agricultural's proposal is comprehensive, effective, reasonable, verifiable, and enforceable. One key component of the ag proposal is the farm plan. The farm plan is an important element of any new ag program. Farm plans are the identification of management practices and improvements that are currently being or will be implemented to address water quality. The draft ag proposal recommends the continued use of farm plans for specific and limited use. Farm plans are kept on site or in the farm offices. Annual farm reports can be submitted by each grower. All growers will update their farm plans after renewal of the ag waiver. Farm plans will be available for inspection by the regional board staff, and business operational records are proprietary and remain confidential. The farm plans and the existing and current ag waiver are appropriately tailored and have a concrete nexus with improving water quality. The farm plans developed in the 2004 waiver were for the growers to use and retain on farm. The contents were kept confidential. The goal of these plans was to focus growers on the elements of farming which impact water quality. As such, these farm plans have been very successful. What does not work is what is being proposed in staff's draft waiver, which is turning useful farm plans into compliance tools. Staff's draft requirements are time-consuming, expensive, and only increase paperwork rather than appreciable benefits to water quality. The contents of staff's draft waiver require highly detailed information, much of which will have to be done by consultants and experts, will be highly time-consuming, overly expensive, and the resulting data will be voluminous and mostly unrelated to water quality. In addition, there are major legal issues such as confidentiality. Regional board staff would be able to require growers to send a copy of the farm plan with 30 days' notice. The contents would then become public record. These reporting business and operational data individual to each farm is detrimental and jeopardizes the farmer if it becomes public. Farm plans should continue to be used as educational tools specifically tailored to individual farms. They should not be morphed into compliance documents and turned into enforceable public permits to farm. Therefore, agriculture proposes the continued use of farm plans for specific purposes. They should be maintained on site but available for regional board inspection upon noticed request. Farm plans should remain a self-assessment tool, a document that would contain an outline of a grower's efforts to improve water quality while remaining on their operation as part of their business plan. Farming operations would revise and update their farm plans within an appropriate set time prior or period after the adoption of the waiver, and revisions of the farm plans could include descriptions and or discussions on how farming operations intend to implement certain management practices to improve water quality and comply with the conditions of the ag waiver. In lieu of submission of a farm plan, each grower could be required to submit an annual report of practices similar in format to the Monterey County Water Resources Agency annual agricultural water conservation plan. This will provide meaningful information to the regional board to evaluate farm and practice changes from the prior year. The Monterey County Water Resources Agency receives the reports from individual growers, which holds this information as confidential business records and assembles an annual report from all of the information submitted. The regional board should adopt the same procedure for handling these reports as confidential business records. Another component of the proposal is education. As stated in staff's most recent staff report, staff does not view education as an appropriate requirement in lieu of or as an indicator of implementation milestones or pollution load reductions and water quality outcomes. However, staff later states that education is an important component of an irrigated lands program that leads to the implementation of new effective management practices that protect and enhance water quality. This last statement is made various times throughout the staff report and supporting documentation and is true. A major part of the success of the 2004 waiver is due to the educational component. Education is not only relevant, important, but is also essential. Education brings about change. Success of the current conditional ag waiver can be credited to grower participation and educational hours completed by grower. Therefore, ag proposes that all enrollees must complete 5 hours of water quality-related education within 5 years. Continued education and training outreach will lead to actual water quality results and benefits implemented on field. Land use regulations. The agriculture proposal does not contain provisions for land use regulations such as riparian vegetation requirements and buffers. Regulating land use is not within the purview of the Regional Water Quality Control Board. The Water Code and the Basin Plan focus on water quality and activities which may impair water quality. While there is authority to prohibit an act which may result in discharge, there is no authority to require an act which is unrelated to discharges to waters of the state. Further explanation will be provided in the legal presentations to come. In addition, the ag proposal would like to comment on nurseries. Rather than single out nurseries, the ag proposal recommends that it is better to establish water quality improvement goals and allow nursery operators discretion in reaching this target. Nurseries have a better understanding of the unique needs of the varieties of plants they grow and their ability to improve water quality.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young, Water Board members, Mr. Briggs. My name is Sarah Green. I'm the Technical Program Manager for the Cooperative Monitoring Program. I'm going to present to you a proposal for a future water quality monitoring program that the ag community would like to present as an alternative to the concepts put forward by your staff, and that we feel is considerably more to the point of water quality improvement. I'll also make a few comments on the concepts put forward by your staff, but I would note that it's a little bit difficult to comment on this, given that we haven't yet received an actual draft proposal for the MRP itself. In the current order, we have a core cooperative monitoring program, or CMP. There's a requirement for follow-up monitoring in addition to the core monitoring program, and in practice, there's been no farm-level monitoring. In the concepts put forward by your staff, there's an expanded core CMP that roughly doubles the number of constituents that would be looked at on a regular basis. There's a provision for additional monitoring, and there's a rather expensive reported monitoring program proposed to assess individual compliance. The ag community proposes maintaining the core CMP approximately as it stands today. But we will be conducting a more thorough review of the program, and that's scheduled to be delivered to your staff later this year. So if any changes appeared necessary at that point, they'd certainly be considered. The ag community is also proposing a more focused watershed approach to improve upon the follow-up monitoring concept in the current waiver. And finally, the ag community believes that farm-level sampling is absolutely key to improving water quality, but it has to be affordable, and it needs to maintain a focus on adaptive management to elicit water quality change. Looking in more detail at the core CMP, we're currently looking at 15 constituents on a monthly basis and 4 toxicity-related constituents on a less frequent schedule. I'd like to take just a minute to clarify what is meant by toxicity here, and I believe also in the previous presentations by your staff and some environmental stakeholders that recited DPR data on toxicity. Toxicity refers to aquatic toxicity to water fleas, fathead minnows, and green algae. It does not refer to toxicity to humans. To put it in perspective, where's Steve? I do swim in the Salinas River, and sometimes I even swallow a little bit of water, but I wouldn't fill a bottle from it. I'd also like to take just a minute to comment on the criticism that the Cooperative Monitoring Program doesn't adequately address dissolved oxygen. I do appreciate the slides shown by Santa Barbara Channel Keeper that took the time to show actual dissolved oxygen data. It's unfortunate that they didn't take the time to look at CMP data, but fortunately, I think if they take a second look at their own slide, it will demonstrate my next point nicely, and that is that waters that exhibit depressed oxygen levels in pre-dawn hours also exhibit oxygen supersaturation during the day. We see this all the time in the cooperative monitoring data. Your own staff, Mary Adams and Aaron Kersthold, have taken a look at this already. And while I'll definitely take a second look at this in the cooperative monitoring data, I think to call it a serious flaw or to say that it's not addressed at all demonstrates a certain level of ignorance about the cooperative monitoring program and also about water quality in general. So getting back to the current monitoring program, the current suite of constituents represents analytical costs on an annual basis of about $314,000. And even though there's a rationale for every single one of these constituents, a sort of natural selection has taken place over the last few years in which we find ourselves coming back all the time to the same 4 what I'll call problem-solving constituents, and those are the ones we always come back to diagnose, communicate, and troubleshoot farm discharge issues. Also, in the current order, we use special projects to look at additional constituents of concern. The proposal being put forward by your staff would basically double the number of constituents that the Cooperative Monitoring Program looks at, raising our annual analytical budget by 87%. At the end of the day, we would still have our four problem-solving constituents, which we're already monitoring. In the ag proposal, it proposes keeping the core monitoring program at roughly the same level of constituents, and again, falling back on the same four problem-solving constituents. The current order prescribes follow-up monitoring to be performed in addition to the core CMP to, quote, improve understanding of the aerial source, scope, and severity of the problem such that better feedback can be provided to farmers related to management practice implementation. In the concepts put forward by your staff, the additional monitoring provision sounds approximately equal to what we have now as follow-up monitoring, except that there's no stated objective related to furthering grower efforts to improve water quality. The ag community proposes a watershed approach using upstream monitoring and on-farm sampling, both of which were implemented very successfully in 2008, and you have data from those programs already. This combined approach would publicly identify source areas for water quality impairment, privately identify farm-specific sources, and the ag community definitely recognizes that any reporting generated from this approach would need to confirm that the practices being implemented on the ground by growers are indeed improving water quality. Regarding farm-level sampling and monitoring, there's a provision for this in the current order, but effectively none has been required. The ag community actually recognized this information gap a few years ago and voluntarily designed and implemented an on-farm sampling program. The goal of that sampling program is, first and foremost, problem discovery, and after that, it's sampling to support adaptive management by growers to see if the steps they're taking to improve water quality are actually doing their job. This kind of sampling costs less than $250 per sample, and in some cases costs less than $50 per sample. In about 12 months between 2008 and 2009, I made almost 40 farm visits, and we had almost 100% voluntary participation by growers on the Quail Creek watershed. This is a very, very successful approach. In the concepts put forward by your staff, there would be a two-pronged approach to reported farm monitoring to verify if farm discharges meet water quality standards. Based on the constituent list put forward by your staff and cost quotes I received from analytical laboratories, the cost per sample of this program would be over $1,000 per sample. The ag community proposes continuing the highly successful confidential on-farm sampling program. Results would stay on the farm. The focus would stay on problem discovery and adaptive management to improve water quality. And the cost of the samples would stay affordable. Even though all of these scenarios sound kind of similar because they all talk about testing water at the farm level, I'd like to suggest that what we're really looking at is apples and oranges. Regulatory verification monitoring has to be prescribed in detail, and it has to be somewhat constant across dischargers. It has to have rigorous quality assurance standards. It has to have standardized reporting formats, cookbook instructions about where and when to sample. So on an operation that has hundreds of plantings and thousands of irrigation events in a season, I don't know how you begin to collect a sample that is representative and meaningful for the purpose of regulatory compliance. I'd also like to suggest that this program, as proposed by your staff, is going to result in a flood of data to your office that is difficult, if not impossible, to interpret, coming into an office that has already shown itself to be challenged by the existing stream of data. I actually think it will be to the great credit of your staff if they can craft a regulation that ensures that the focus of on-farm testing stays on problem discovery and giving growers the data that they need to troubleshoot their discharge problems so that we can see improved water quality at the bottom of the watershed. Now I'd like to explain why this watershed approach is the most direct and efficient way to identify water quality issues and solve them. Upstream monitoring is when we basically temporarily add sites upstream of the core cooperative monitoring site to look for source areas for constituents of concern that we're finding at the bottom of the watershed. It provides better spatial resolution than the core CMP, identifies source areas. In some cases, in 2008, this kind of monitoring showed that all areas of the watershed were source areas. In other cases, it showed that discharges from wastewater treatment plants were contributing substantially to the, quote, ag water quality problems. We also learned via upstream monitoring which of our water bodies have stream flows that actually originate at the top of the watershed versus those where in-stream flows are composed 100% of anthropogenic discharges. Most importantly, upstream monitoring helps us to focus our outreach efforts so that we know which areas are most in need of on-farm testing. On-farm sampling assists farmers in diagnosing their farm's water quality issues and also verifies whether or not management practices are doing their job. It focuses on discharge volume or flow, fertilizers, so nitrogen and phosphorus, sediment or turbidity, and pesticides, mainly OPs and pyrethroids. Those are the ones we've looked at to date. It's implemented differently on every farm and is fundamentally different from reported compliance monitoring. I'd like to share with you some of the lessons we've learned during on-farm sampling, but I just want to preface it first by asking everyone to bear in mind that on-farm sampling is conducted on farms with current tailwater issues. That's a small subset of farms on the Central Coast, so we're not talking about all farms here. And other farms have either resolved their issues or didn't have them to begin with. I'd like to also acknowledge the long history of technical assistance to growers that the Cooperative Extension, NRCS, RCDs, and the Ag Water Quality Coalition and the Aqua Partnership has. I certainly don't want to minimize those efforts with my next comments. I also want to acknowledge the importance of vegetative and conservation type management practices. All that said, what we're finding when we go on farm is that each farm's water quality issues are unique and that no single practice will help in all situations. We find that existing vegetative and other conservation type practices typically do not resolve water quality issues. New vegetative or conservation type management practices are also typically not suggested by the data that you get when you actually sample on farm. The results rarely suggest that fertilizer adjustments will meaningfully address nitrate issues. They do not suggest that off-the-shelf solutions like applying less or using a different formulation will address the pesticide issues. They rarely suggest that irrigation distribution uniformity will address the runoff issues. And they also suggest that riparian buffers will not mitigate the major transport mechanisms for farm products that are currently entering streams. So to be very clear about that, the results of our on-farm sampling to date indicate that mandatory best management practices will not improve water quality. What we have is a plethora of partially effective management practices. We have few or no universally effective management practices. What needs to happen on many of the farms could better be termed operational changes than what we'd traditionally think of as best management practices. Also, upon identifying their discharge issues, many growers elect to simply turn their attention to reducing or eliminating their tailwater. But I've never worked with a grower who thought that they could afford to do that overnight.
Do you mind telling us what you mean by operational changes?
So I'm using the term to distinguish from things we traditionally think of as best management practices, such as grassline ditches, other things like that. For example, a lot of times we find that most of the nitrate content of tailwater comes from the irrigation source. So changing fertilizer practices is not going to address the nitrate level in that tailwater. The grower, if they're forced to comply with the nitrate standards, needs to make some other kind of change in their operation to either prevent that water from leaving their farm or find a way to remove those nitrates from the tailwater, and there's few or no technologies that can do that at a meaningful scale right now.
Do you mean the source water has nitrate in it, and that's what's causing the exceedance?
In many cases, yes.
And that the application of fertilizers is not adding to that problem?
I think I could probably find some actual data from the UC that I could cite to demonstrate the point more quantitatively, but surprisingly, yes, it's remarkably constant across soil types and fertilizer application practices. The amount of nitrate picked up as the water moves across the field often pales in comparison to what's being introduced from the irrigation source itself.
Okay. I did stop the clock while I interrupted
okay.
you, so go ahead.
So what will make water quality change happen? I needed to say something else positive. There is a way forward. There are solutions, but I don't think they're going to look like the suite of traditional best management practices that we're all, including myself 3 years ago, so fond of. So what will make water quality change happen? Is it happening? What does it look like? How can we detect it? This is a really complex issue. We've taken a preliminary look at it using the Mann-Kendall test. That's a test that looks for monotonic trends, which is a trend that sort of moves constantly in one direction. Not all water quality trends even look like that. Some of them look like a step trend in which water quality is relatively constant, and then it makes a big jump or big decline, and then it becomes constant again. So we need to apply a different test to look for other kinds of trends. So far, we've looked at three important constituents: nitrates, turbidity, and flow. And turbidity is basically a proxy for suspended sediment. We've looked at this at 27 sites in the Salinas and Santa Maria areas, most of which had 4 years of data. And we found very few trends in nitrate or turbidity and approximately equal numbers of trends in the upwards and downwards directions. Also, these refer to not, you know, you look at the graph and you see the data moving one direction or the other. These are statistically significant trends. I think the big news here is that we saw zero increasing trends in flow, and 18 out of 27 sites had decreasing trends in flow. Given that a large number of these sites are heavily impacted by irrigation tailwater, those declines in flow could indicate reductions in farm runoff. The trends also took place over a period of time when we had some drought, so they're probably also influenced by climate, and I think time will tell whether or not those trends continue. Asking ourselves what will change look like, if you could bear with me in sort of a technical slide here. This first example above the line that I'm going to give is sort of a more typical example in which we have discharge number one is going to be, let's say it's a dam release from the San Antonio Nacimiento dams at the top of the Salinas River. That's going to be a very low nitrate discharge. Let's say there's a farm discharge that's high nitrate, low flow coming in there. If you eliminate that farm discharge, discharge number two, the nitrate concentration in the river is going to go down. That's kind of what we all expect to see. Something else we might see, though, where we have discharge-only streams with no base flow, which is actually a surprising number of our cooperative monitoring sites, if you've got a high nitrate, low flow discharge and a low nitrate, high flow discharge, both from ag operations, if you eliminate discharge number two in that case, you're left with your high nitrate, low flow discharge, and the nitrate concentration in the stream goes up. So is that an example of improving or worsening water quality? That's something we need to consider as we move forward. The last thing I want to look at is a qualitative evaluation of change. That's when we don't have enough data to do statistical evaluations. This is an example of some diazinon concentration data that we have. It's just three data points, samples taken in September of 2006, 2008, and 2009. But seven of the eight sites that we have the time series for had dramatic reductions in diazinon concentrations, and we saw the same thing in chlorpyrifos concentrations in Santa Maria. Now, these data are insufficient for statistical trend analysis, but they show a pretty convincing trend. So monthly trend monitoring for diazinon would cost nearly $600,000 over a five-year waiver period. Is it worth $600,000 to be able to say diazinon levels are significantly lower instead of diazinon levels appear to be decreasing? That's something we need to ask ourselves as we go about designing and potentially adding constituents to the core monitoring program. So I'd just like to leave you with this thought, that water quality change may look different than expected and may be brought about in unanticipated ways. And the agriculture community is proposing future monitoring that will support efforts to improve water quality and that takes an informed approach to detecting change. Thank you.
One quick question for you. Could the decreasing levels of diazinon be related to drought conditions?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The decreasing levels of diazinon, could that be attributed to drought conditions?
Could that be attributed to?
To drought.
Drought conditions?
Climate.
In what way?
I'm not sure. But it's related, it's related to rainfall and then, you know, flow that you would see and the transportation of chemicals across farmland into a receiving water.
Right. If it was climate related in a time of drought, I would actually expect to see the diazinon concentrations going up because, again, you'd have the same discharges going into a less diluting stream of base flow. And we actually don't have much base flow here on the Central Coast, but if we did, that's what we'd expect to see.
Okay. Mr. Shawcross?
Yeah. You said something in passing about monitoring upstream and downstream and sort of zeroing in on where the problem was, if that was indeed the case in a particular stretch. And then you said something about you could privately ID individual problems. What did you mean by privately?
I was talking about kind of the approach we've taken to date, which is where we do our upstream monitoring. So we go to a public access site that basically cuts off a whole segment of the watershed, and that tells us if that area is a source area. By the time you're down to that small an area of the watershed, you're talking about relatively few dischargers. So then it's just a matter of pounding the pavement. You go to all the farms, you talk to the growers, and help each one to identify what their discharge issues are. And because we have the publicly reported data showing that that area of the watershed is a problem, I'm not sure how much more the public interest is served by having data from each little farm on that section of the watershed.
I see. So, but when you said privately, you meant going onto private property?
Oh, no, I meant that.
Or you're keeping the information private.
At that point, the data stays private with the grower. Yeah.
With the grower. Okay, so my question there then is, as since we're an enforcement agency, how do we enforce if we don't have information? Let's say there's a problem grower. I mean, someone who just doesn't want to get with the program.
I'm sorry. Somebody doesn't want to?
Doesn't want to get with the program. They don't want to change their practices. So how do we enforce if we don't have the information? And maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're suggesting.
Yeah, and I guess I don't want to speculate too much because I'm not a regional board staff member, but my understanding is that the approach they've taken to date has been in areas that they feel are problem areas, they've been then going on farm to inspect those operations to see if it looks like there might be a violation occurring.
Oh, so you're saying that the staff would get that information?
I
the regional board staff would get that information.
The regional board staff are always, I believe, able to go on to,
no.
to make inspections.
Okay. I'm not sure. It sounded to me like you're saying that someone, you or someone, would be privately, if they found a problem case, they would be going to that person and say, you've got a problem.
Now, right.
That's fine. I like that. What if the guy doesn't want to cooperate? Then what happens with the information? Do we get the information at some point so that we can do what we're supposed to do and enforce the law?
So you're saying, what if in response to this water quality data that is not public, available, a grower doesn't decide to...
I almost don't care if it's not publicly available at some point, but at some point, how do we enforce the law?
Okay, I think somebody else
might
want to
respond. If you're asking
respond.
Us to just let you go privately...
I think the regional board has the power to go to that farm and make the farm...
And how would we know to go to that farm?
Well, you know it's a small area and you go...
Oh, okay, that's what I mean. We would be getting some information.
Yes.
Okay, that's all I want to know. That's all I want to know.
If I might add, your staff already has that information. We submitted a very detailed report.
That's what I didn't understand.
Okay.
I thought you were just keeping it all to yourself.
No, you already have that information.
Okay, thank you.
Now I will be addressing groundwater, something you've heard a lot about this morning. The key thing that I think both your presentation this morning and our presentation deal with is the complexity of groundwater. The agricultural proposal is to look at existing agency or third party to develop a groundwater management plan within 5 years of the adoption of the waiver. We think this is appropriate because some counties like Santa Barbara, Santa Clara, and Monterey County already have done extensive information, have developed extensive information regarding each aquifer in their county. However, if we look at the region as a whole, it's difficult to apply one plan to all of it because each of the aquifers is unique, whether it's Santa Maria, Salinas, the Pajaro, or the Upper Pajaro, because of the source of the water, whether there's saltwater intrusion, whether or not they have imported water or reservoirs to supply water. Just looking at the Salinas Valley, again, because this has been well-researched by the Monterey County Water Resources Agency, almost all of the recharge in the Salinas Valley is in the area around Soledad, where the Arroyo Seco and Salinas Rivers come together. And the rest of the valley to the north, to the northwest has little recharge, particularly into the lower aquifers. If you look at just Monterey County again, the aquifers are very diverse and totally unique as far as where your farm may be compared to the well you have and the impact of your farming operation on water below your farm. Farmers and municipalities have looked at this differentiation of aquifers and where they place their wells. And Monterey County Water Resources Agency and the FOG report determined that changes in the loading of the surface water at the surface will correspond with changes in the groundwater in 40 to 50 years. So the groundwater reflects things that have occurred a long time ago on the surface. Nitrate concentrations may continue to rise for many years to come, regardless of changes in land use. However, in 1987, Monterey County Water Resources Agency commissioned a report to deal with nitrates in groundwater, which predicted a doubling of nitrates in groundwater in subsequent years. However, it turned out in a report prepared in 1993 that there was a rate of equilibrium in change of groundwater. If you look at this map, the red dots show areas where there's an increase in nitrates in the groundwater, while the blue dots indicate there's a decrease in nitrates in groundwater. There's a new report being prepared that's going to be called the 2009 Nitrate Report, which shows consistent change with this, where you have areas increasing nitrates and areas of decreasing nitrates within the Salinas Valley aquifers. So it appears that we're at a point of equilibrium, and there's not a condition where the aquifer is getting progressively worse. However, if we look just at agricultural's contribution to this and the proposal to mandate fertilizer application restrictions, Professors Hartz, Kahn, and Smith from UC Davis and UC Ag Extension wrote a letter in your packet called T1, which stated it was impossible for vegetable and strawberry growers to consistently meet these low nitrate leachate standards. Some leachate is inevitable, and this is their words. Some leaching may be needed to manage salts. However, they felt that there was a significant flaw in staff's approach to this, that the key has to be the load and not the concentration. This is similar to what Sarah's presentation talked about as far as observing change in surface water flows, and that they felt that a emphasis on concentration without addressing load was problematic. I will now address management practices. It's key to implement management practices that are designed to improve water quality. The draft requires substantial paperwork without any related water quality management improvement on the farm. We have to fit the implementation of practices to the unique circumstance on each farm. They vary by soil, topography, water quality, and crop. And so the practice needs to be tailored to those unique circumstances. There are several areas that are singled out in the draft proposal and are dealt with in the alternate proposal. Surface tailwater is related to soil and slope. It is not crop specific. The goal needs to be to improve water quality and not farming prohibitions. Tile drains are necessary due to high groundwater. Without tile drains, highly productive farmland will become fallow, Property values in those areas will plummet, and property taxes will decline. Timelines are raised in the staff's draft, and timelines to some extent are appropriate. However, we need to recognize that good faith efforts to achieve desired results that may not succeed within the timelines should not be punished. Adaptive management practices requires evaluation of implementations, which takes time. There are some unique circumstances in the watersheds dealing with tailwater and impaired watersheds, and this has been discussed extensively today. These are good farms with educated and skilled farmers on them. The reason tailwater exists is because of the difficult local circumstances dealing with soil topography and slope. The growers should be allowed good faith efforts to improve water quality, not imposed a mandatory 2-year deadline in order to eliminate all tailwater from their farms in these areas. As Sarah pointed out, there are practices that growers have put in that have failed. We should not penalize growers who have tried to implement practices that did not work to immediately solve the problem. There was also a discussion about nurseries with pots, and I think that has been dealt with by staff, that they've recognized that rain is a natural occurrence. However, farmers should get credit for practices that they've been putting in over a period of time. In 1993, there was just over 3,000 acres of drip in the Salinas Valley. In 2009, there was 51,000 acres of drip in the Salinas Valley. Much of this was put in during the 5 years of the waiver as growers tried to reduce their irrigation runoff. This is an increase in drip line installed in the Salinas Valley of 13,000%. There was also almost 100% reduction in furrow irrigation in the Salinas Valley. So farmers have been doing things that are very expensive but are very productive in improving water quality and reducing tailwater flow.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and members of the board and Mr. Briggs. You've heard agriculture's plan for moving forward.
Your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Abby Taylor Silva with the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. I'd now like to speak to you regarding the economic impact of the Water Board's proposed ag waiver on Central Coast agriculture. Porter Colon states, prior to implementation of any agricultural water quality control program, an estimate of the total cost of such a program, together with an identification of potential sources of financing, shall be indicated in any regional water quality control plan. We realize the proposed waiver is a draft, and we can only hope that it will be modified. The proposal, as it's currently written, even with changes, has the capability to put a number of growers out of business, which will have a substantial and detrimental effect on our Central Coast economy. The County of Monterey reviewed the proposed waiver and in their letter to the board made some compelling points regarding the economic impact of this proposal on the communities of Monterey County. They estimated that the proposed regulation would result in the loss of farmland, including prime farmland and farmland of statewide importance. Specifically, the proposed agricultural order requires up to 100 feet of riparian buffer to be actively installed and maintained along rivers and streams, resulting in a significant loss of agricultural land in Monterey County alone. Additionally, common farming food safety practices dictate that crops have a 50-foot buffer from adjacent riparian habitat. For the purposes of our analysis, the county calculated that this proposal is asking for a cumulative buffer of 150 feet. Due to the magnitude of the project and time constraints, the County of Monterey's analysis was limited to 3 watersheds, including Pajaro River Watershed, the portion in Monterey County only, Alisal and Elkhorn Sloughs, and the Salinas River Watershed. Because this analysis is only for 3 watersheds and is not inclusive of the full loss of crop acreage in Monterey County, much less the Central Coast region, it is not taking into account total potential loss of land. However, based on the 3 watersheds analyzed, 14,343 acres of prime farmland and farmland of statewide importance would be taken out of agricultural production. Average gross production value in Monterey County is over $16,000 per acre. equaling a loss of production value totaling $237 million when multiplied by those 14,000 plus acres I just mentioned. Land values and corresponding rent values would decline to reflect the changes in land use from agricultural to wildlife riparian and conservation issues. Applying the average rent value of $1,400 per acre, the proposed buffer would result in a direct economic impact totaling $20 million. The changes in land uses would impact property values and create a loss of property tax value in an already undercapitalized Monterey County. Next. Our local communities rely on the agricultural community. It is reasonable and prudent to anticipate that the financial impact on local residents, including loss of jobs, loss of health insurance, reduced work hours, and more, may result in an increased demand for county social services, further straining local budgets. Riparian habitat restoration would first require the management and eradication of invasive species. Doing so is critical for successful native revegetation and would be a significant cost. For example, Arundodonax is one invasive plant prevalent along the Salinas River that chokes out native riparian species. It is estimated that it would cost over $3 million to treat Arundo along the Salinas River. Finally, it appears as though the proposed agricultural order may go beyond the jurisdiction and common practice of the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board by attempting to indirectly influence land use. The Growers Shipper Association also conducted an economic analysis of the current proposal, basing our estimations on implementation throughout the Central Coast over a five-year period. As I previously stated, it is expected that the proposal will be amended. It should also be noted that aspects of the proposed waiver were ambiguous, and therefore it was difficult to assess the proposed cost. Every effort, however, was made to be fair about anticipated impacts. For example, few specifics were provided regarding grower monitoring and reporting. Are growers required to monitor on a monthly or quarterly basis? Are they required to monitor in one location per farm or at each discharge point? For the sake of simplicity, we made a conservative assumption that the growers will only have to sample one time annually and once per operation for a cost of $1,600 per year. Our next step was to conduct grower interviews of cool season vegetables, avocado, and grape growers. Warm season vegetables and stone fruit growers will definitely feel the economic impact of compliance requirements on a localized basis as well. However, the acreage of these crops is not significant to the overall Central Coast economy, and we could not justify the resources to do grower interviews of those crops. Additionally, we were unable to conduct strawberry grower interviews, although this proposal would affect 22,992 strawberry acres throughout the Central Coast, or 68% of the California strawberry acreage. We know that because strawberries are so highly sensitive to salt, this proposal could have catastrophic events on the strawberry industry and wipe out significant strawberry production. Hence, the costs presented here do not estimate the true extent of the economic impact, and they are limited only to the commodities for which interviews were conducted, which again were cool season vegetables, avocado, and grape growers. Grower interviews concentrated on the cost of compliance in a field of a specific size and with specific parameters rather than for a grower's entire operation, and field sizes in question ranged from 14 to 500 acres. This approach allowed us to calculate a cost per acre and economies of scale are reflected for the larger operations. Consequently, we estimated minimum and maximum costs of compliance with this proposal per acre as shown below. Avocados up to $2,189 an acre, cool season vegetables up to $660 an acre, and wine grapes up to $519 an acre. Now multiply this by 14, 500, 1,000 or more acres, and you'll comprehend the substantial cost of implementing the preliminary proposal as it's currently written. Next, the cost per acre was multiplied by the number of acres per commodity in Santa Clara, San Benito, Santa Cruz, Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. These data were based on the County Agricultural Commissioner reports, and these calculations estimated Central Coast lost business revenue to be between $231 and $298 million. Finally, an economist inserted the minimum and maximum lost business revenue into a model used to calculate lost indirect tax revenue, lost labor income, and lost employment. Lost indirect tax revenue consists of lost property, sales and excise taxes, fees and licenses that would have been paid by businesses. Taxes on profits or income and lost taxes from declining property values are not included in these estimates. Lost labor income includes all forms of employee compensation that would have been paid by employers. Lost employment demonstrates the number of jobs lost and is calculated in a full-time equivalent employment value on an annual basis. We expect that lost employment will not be consistent across the region, but will be concentrated in Monterey and Santa Barbara counties. For example, in 2007 in Monterey County, 21% or 38,000 employees depended directly upon agriculture for employment, while 54% or 45,000 depended on agriculture indirectly. The model indicates that lost tax revenue, as you can see on this slide, is between $19 and $25 million, which would have a devastating impact on local economies. Additionally, lost labor income between $87 and $112 million could conclude an estimated 2,500 to 3,300 jobs would be lost. Total output losses are total, Total output losses are total revenues lost for a given time period for an industry in dollars, and this is the best measure of lost business and economic activity. Our model indicates that total output losses are between $364 and $470 million. Okay. Here you'll notice the median gross revenue sales by farm. A reminder, a median is the midpoint of the range of numbers that are arranged in order of value. 50% of the growers have greater gross sales revenue, and 50% of the growers have less gross sales revenue than the ranges presented here. Note that this is not net profit, so it does not include growing and harvesting costs. The point of interest here is that the compliance costs for the conditional waiver could potentially exceed the median gross sales revenue of 50% of the growers in most counties. This will unfairly target small, family-owned farms, some of which are organic or owned by disenfranchised growers such as Spanish or other language-speaking growers. Finally, we noted that a certain percent of commodities might not be able to sustain the cost of the proposed conditional ag waiver. Cool season vegetables, strawberries, and nursery crops are considered to be crops at risk, and these three commodities comprise 75.8% of all acres grown on the Central Coast. This proposal would have devastating economic effects on Central Coast agriculture. Agriculture is committed to being actively engaged in continuing to improve water quality, but these costly management practices, which have the capability to put a number of growers out of business, are not sure bets. We cannot be sure that this plan will improve water quality, only that it will negatively impact our economy, and we won't get a second chance to take it back. If we put the growers out of business, where is the money going to come from to improve water quality? Our local agricultural economy funds infrastructure and social programs throughout our cities and counties, directly provides jobs for tens of thousands, and indirectly provides jobs to many more. It also feeds the world with the nutritious and safe produce that we grow here on the Central Coast. We encourage you to make a choice that takes our local economy's needs into consideration, and we await your economic analysis of this and any future proposals, as is required by Puerto Colón and CEQA. And I thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you today.
Comments.